for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. It's the day before Thanksgiving, so for this month's Reader's Review, we turn our attention to family. For five decades, Ann Tyler's stories have explored the complex relationship between spouses, siblings, parents, and children. In her ninth novel, Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant, she introduces us to the Tulls, a controlling mother, an absent father, and three children struggling to establish a sense of family in the wake of their own turbulent childhoods. Joining me for the discussion, novelist Laura Lippman, Kevin Roy of the University of Maryland, and author and journalist Rachel Louise Snyder. I'm sure many of you have read this novel, but even if you haven't, feel free to join us by phone. 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Well, welcome to all of you and happy day before Thanksgiving.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Wonderful to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Good to see you. You know, the first page of this book tells us that the central character is dying, so we know we're going to get her reflections. And I found this book so powerful in its rendition of family. Certainly dysfunctional family, but perhaps all families are exactly dysfunctional in very different ways. But Laura Lippman, read for us the passage on page 22 where Pearl talks about her children.
Something was wrong with him. Something was wrong with all of her children. They were so frustrating, attractive, likable people, the three of them, but closed off from her in some perverse way that she couldn't quite put her finger on. And she sensed a kind of trademark flaw in each of their lives. Cody was prone to unreasonable rages. Jenny was so flippant. Ezra hadn't really lived up to his potential. He ran a restaurant on St. Paul Street, not at all what she had planned for him. She wondered if her children blamed her for something, sitting close at family gatherings, with the spouses and offspring slightly apart, non-members forever. They tended to recall only poverty and loneliness, toys she couldn't afford for them, parties where they weren't invited. Cody, in particular, referred constantly to Pearl's short temper, displaying it against a background of stunned, childish faces, so sad and bewildered that Pearl herself hardly recognized them. Honestly, she thought, wasn't there some statute of limitations here? When was he going to absolve her? He was middle-aged. He had no business holding her responsible anymore. And Beck, well, he was still alive if it mattered. By now he'd be old. She would bet he'd aged poorly. She would bet he wore a toupee, or false teeth too white and regular, or some flowing youthful hairdo that made him look ridiculous. His ties would be too colorful and his suits too bold a plaid. What had she ever seen in him? She chewed the insides of her lips. Her one mistake, a simple error in judgment. It should not have had such far-reaching effects. You would think that life could be a little more forgiving.
Laura Lippman, reading from Ann Tyler's book, Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant. Kevin Roy, was Beck the primary mistake that Pearl made?
It sure seems like he was the beginning of where she draws it all back to. She says this is where it all started. And she said it was her one accomplishment in life, is to get her kids through that, you know, absence of him. I think from Pearl's perspective, that might have been the case. I think as you see over time, as she reflects and her kids reflect, there's a lot more there. That Beck takes on a meaning that perhaps was wasn't there in the 40s when he left.
Why was Beck attracted to Pearl in the beginning?
That's interesting. She was a lot older than him. He had this kind of, you know, very suave presence, right?
And
that's why she was attracted to him.
Yeah.
It's interesting to speculate why, you know, he was attracted to her. Maybe she was stable. She had this sense of being someone you could have a family with, and he could really rely on to kind of pull him through probably the rest of his life.
And yet, Rachel, he leaves when the kids are quite young. Just walks out the door.
It's hard to imagine. It's so hard to imagine. And, it speaks to her level of craftsmanship, because as a parent, I just think, you know, how could you do that and never come back? And it just shatters the family in a way. I mean, and the thing that's interesting about it is Pearl's reaction, which is complete disassociation, right? This isn't happening, la, 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 you know.
And she keeps telling the kids that their father is off on a sales trip that lasts 35 years. I mean, how can this be?
Maybe he sold an entire country. It takes a while. It was shocking that she can get away with it. And at some point, the kids clue in. And it's interesting how that unwraps in the novel, because you don't find out till later, maybe a third of the way through the book, that they actually knew that he wasn't coming back. And so they all sort of collectively had a tacit agreement not to discuss it.
I found some of the most painful scenes in this book, Laura Lippman, to be those when Pearl just lost it and took it out on those kids.
It's terrifically painful, and it's even more painful when you see that behavior repeat itself through Jenny as a young single mother.
Jenny being
her daughter, who also finds herself on her own with a child, not in a, you know, in a circumstance that she hadn't foreseen. I first read this book either the year it came out or the year after, when I was in my 20s. And I reread it for this discussion, and I'm now in my 50s, but also the daughter of a young child.
And the mother of a young child, sorry.
And the experiences were so different. And the way I came to the text as a mother, as someone who had lived a lot more, really changed the book. I remember I was speaking to Kevin briefly outside, and I said, the first time I read this, I identified with the children, although the children are really more of my parents' generation. But, like, you know, I knew what it was like to be someone's child and to rebel against it and to have your differences and to create, you know, to have this necessary distance at some point in your adult life in which you have to go out on your own and be yourself, and then you can come home again. And this time, reading about Pearl's frustration, and I think there's so much genius in Ann Tyler. Yeah. But part of this is that she is not portrayed monstrously. It's terrible. You feel everyone in those scenes. You feel Pearl's frustration, her concern, her sense of being overmatched. And the scene that really brought it home for me is actually a very quiet scene in which Cody, the oldest brother, has played yet another trick on Ezra. He's always trying to show Ezra up. And he's gone to great lengths to create these fake these photographs in which it looks like Ezra has passed out from drinking. And, you know, he's so clever that his mother is the one who goes to pick them up at the drugstore or wherever they've been developed. And she comes home and she has this really naked, exposed moment in which she talks to Cody almost as if he's an adult for the first time. And she is so devastated to find out that she has made this confession after being tricked. And it does not, I think in some writers' hands, this would be a more sentimental, huggy moment where Cody sees everything from his mom's point of view and she realizes how much she's asked her. Instead, you just have this terribly sad moment of Pearl resenting him, because in her mind, he's tricked her into showing how weak and fragile she is inside.
You know, that scene was fascinating to me, because until the very end of the book was the one moment Cody was honest by confessing that he had created this scenario and that Ezra, his brother, his younger brother, had not really passed out from alcohol, that he, Cody, had tricked him and tried to frame him in his mother's eyes because Cody was jealous. Cody believed that Ezra was the favorite and wanted to do everything he could to disabuse his mother of the notion that Ezra was her angel. And it is with Ezra at the opening of the book that Pearl is dying. We're going to take a short break. I hope you'll join us. 800-433-8850.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. From Novo Nordisk, supporting Diabetes Awareness Month this November. Learn more at novonordisk-us.com. From the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us for our Reader's Review this month, we've chosen Ann Tyler's New York Times bestseller, Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant. Here with me, Rachel Louise Snyder. She's professor of creative writing and journalism at the American University. She's author of Fugitive Denim and the novel What We've Lost Is Nothing. Kevin Roy, associate professor in Department of Family Science at the University of Maryland, and Laura Lipman. She's author of 16 novels, former reporter at the Baltimore Sun. Her new novel, Hush, Hush, will be released in February 2015. And you can send us an email to drshow.org. And if you've read the book and want to share your thoughts, you can do so on Twitter with the hashtag DRReads. But do give us a call as well. 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. And I must say, Laura Lipman talked about the fact that she had read this in her 20s. You, too, for you, Rachel, this second time.
That's right. I read it when it first came out. I read actually a number of her novels. And she, you know, I was an aspiring writer as a teenager, even younger than a teenager. And so for me, people like Ann Tyler and Sue Miller, and they were accessible in a way to me as a young person. But as Laura said, I had a very different experience reading it, having only lived life as someone's child up to that point, as opposed to now. You know, I've been both child and parent. But the thing that I so appreciate about her writing is that she's not a stylist in the way that I would define somebody like Michael Ondaatje, who is a stylist, whose name doesn't have to appear on his work for you to know it's his, or Annie Proulx or somebody like that. She really kind of disappears inside the writing itself, and I think it speaks to the power of her language and her absolute ability to burrow so deeply inside of a character.
Tell me, Kevin Roy, what you thought of Cody, and tell us about Cody.
I think Cody is fascinating. We were talking off air about, you know, who's our favorite character, and Cody for me clearly is. I was, you know, put off by him repeatedly in the book, but I feel that I agree at the beginning and really at the end, he there's a journey in his character. I really feel like when he meets his father at the end, certain things click, and it was kind of very pat things that he realized at the end, even when his father said, I'm proud of you. And this was, he felt like, I've been living all my life for this, and that was it. And I thought, how much that is a linchpin for him, that little switch that's clicked off, and how much of his character is kind of, you know, coming from that, wanting to hear the pride in his father's voice about him. And I also think that it's interesting, the timing at which Beck left and the different ages of the kids really made a difference. And he was the oldest, and I think the father's departure had a different effect on him than the other siblings. And so the timing of that, I think, is important.
It was so interesting to me how Cody's jealousy of his brother Ezra manifested itself. How did you see it, Laura?
Well, I'm obsessed with the scene in which Cody shoots an arrow that ends up lodging itself into his mother's shoulder. It's a story that is in the novel three times, first from Pearl's point of view, then from Cody's point of view, and then it is the last image in the novel is something that Cody saw at that moment, something that I'm not sure that he did see, but he believes now as an adult man that is something he saw that day. So, you know, Cody's anger and resentment of his brother Ezra predates their father leaving. I came out of the novel feeling that Cody was just innately angry. That if it had not been Ezra, there would have been another object of his anger, another object of resentment. But at the same time, he fascinates me because I think he is a good father to Luke. I think he actually does a pretty good job by his son.
He's a pretty darn jealous father.
He is. He doesn't ever transcend that part of his nature. He steals his brother's girlfriend, but he's a good husband for the most part.
Oh, I think totally disagree. Oh my gosh.
He's a real dreamboat.
Oh my gosh.
Who wouldn't want him?
He's difficult, but it's in a marriage that lasts, and I think it's working for both people.
He doesn't give 2 cents about her.
No, I think it works for neither one of them, actually. I find him fabulous as a character, and I resent the idea that characters have to be likable. Like, this is what
sure.
I sort of don't
yeah.
like about Ezra.
Right.
He's too milquetoast for
Uh-oh.
Me. Oh, poor Ezra. I know. I mean, of course he's the guy you want to have children with and grow old with, but, you know, Cody's the one you go clubbing with.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. The fact that Cody, let me put it this way, who shot the arrow that indeed ended up in the mother's shoulder.
Having reread that scene multiple times now, I believe that Ezra is to blame. Cody shoots the arrow, but Ezra tackles him. Cody is standing there. He's doing something horrible. He is doing something indefensible that's very dangerous, which is pretending to aim the arrow at Ezra. He's also pretended to aim it at other places, perhaps at his father, but not at his mother. He does not aim that arrow at his mother. She's not even in his line of sight. Later, when he has the memory that she's gathering a bouquet, that's not in the way he first tells the story.
Okay.
So that's something that's been told to him. Ezra tackles him.
Why does he tackle him? Because
he's aiming an arrow at Ezra.
Of course.
I mean, it is dangerous, it's indefensible, but he is not, he has no intention that we see of letting go.
But he then blames Ezra.
He's not wrong.
I would say that they share equal responsibility, but perhaps we should ask the familial psychologist who is the one to blame.
That's a big question. I mean, who is the one to blame? I'm not sure either of them are. I think what this captures, that arrow to me represents the kind of conflict between them that ultimately kind of lodges itself in their mom.
And she
blames Beck.
Well,
exactly. She blames Beck.
Beck leaves, and he goes off on a sales trip. She's finally taken to the hospital. She is on the mend, but then the infection begins to fester. And, oh, my gosh. I mean, I just saw that as so much of Cody's misbehavior. And, of course, it results in a terrible accident. He's aiming it at everybody. He'd like to get rid of Ezra in his heart. And he does so by stealing his girlfriend.
Right, yeah. But he also lives in a kind of purgatory for that because he's terribly unhappy for the entirety of his life with her. And she's unhappy and Ezra's unhappy. I mean, it's a devastating, devastating folly that he's engaged in with her.
And what does it say that the longest standing marriage in the book is between Cody and Ruth, Ezra's former girlfriend?
What do you think it says?
Not Beck and Pearl, not Jenny, who's had, you know, however many
husbands
she's had.
Yeah. Right.
So, and, you know, there are times when we judge that and say they're unhappy and they're clinging to each other and they're, but Ruth is clearly a different person at the end than she was when she met Ezra, too. So I think there's a lot more to Cody than meets the eye.
I think that Ruth made the best choice. It's not the ideal choice, but if she was going to be with one of those two men, I think she might have made the better choice. And she does say, by the way, it's a really interesting scene in which Cody and Ruth have to sort of come clean to Ezra about what's going on, what's happened. And Ruth keeps saying, it just happened. No one planned this. And the reader, of course, is thinking, oh, no, someone planned it.
Oh, you bet.
Someone very definitely
very
planned it.
Clearly planned it.
But this is, you know, this is so much a book about the stories that people and families tell themselves that explain everything about the family. So that is Ruth's story. Ruth will never know what the reader knows in its entirety. And Ruth will always believe, I think, it just happened, which is a very romantic story and puts this somewhat plain, unsophisticated young woman at the heart of something very thrilling and exciting. And, oh gosh, when she walks to the train on her high heels and asks if there's going to be an eating car. And all she wants to do, my heart just goes, Ruth is one of those secondary characters. We don't see the world through her point of view, really. But she may, in fact, be my favorite character in the book. There's something, there are all
very
these, like,
innocent
shadow novels.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's, like, a whole novel about Beck. I'm not sure it's an interesting novel or a good novel, but there is the story of Beck's life as well. There are a lot of characters. Mrs. Scarlatti is another one.
Indeed. Mrs. Scarlatti, who owns the restaurant in which Ezra works. She becomes ill. Ezra has to take charge of the restaurant. Mrs. Scarlatti, in the end, leaves that restaurant to Ezra, who begins making some very creative changes to the restaurant. He doesn't inform Mrs. Scarlatti while she's ill that he's doing this. But in any event, the restaurant becomes his life. He never leaves his mother's home. And that's sad in the end. Let's open the phones here. Let's go first to Brenda in San Antonio, Texas. Hi there.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking the call.
Surely.
I've enjoyed your show for a long time.
I'm glad.
And when I heard the opening remarks and the passage being read, I just felt I had to call. I haven't read the book, I confess, but it is now on my to-do list.
Good.
I'm the oldest of five siblings. My father left when I was 10 years old. My mother was a broken woman who struggled to survive and, keep us all together. And anyway, just listening, it was as if someone had been, kind of peeking into the windows of my life at the beginning, reading. And so I thank you for the subject matter and
Brenda, tell me how you are now. Are you married with your own family?
Well, I am, but, more than once married. I'm 60 years old, and only in the last, I'll say, 10 years have I come to understand a little bit more about my mother and the choices she made. She struggled for a long time. We were on welfare. If it hadn't been for her efforts, we probably would have gone, in four different directions. But there was a lot of underlying rage about his departure, and I guess you'd call it rejection. And some of her, some of it came out in, painful ways. And my brothers, I have three brothers and one sister, I think that she felt without our father present that discipline, falling to her meant she had to be very assertive, is one way of saying
it. One way to put it, I totally understand. Well, Brenda, I'm glad you called, and thanks for sharing. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I think that that's precisely how this book touches people, because it does represent not just a fictional family, but it takes in the real life experiences of so many.
I couldn't agree more, and I think, there's this debate that's ongoing about the role of the humanities and the age of science and reason in which we're living. And I think, but we need the humanities to explain ourselves to us. We need writing to be able to get us through these dark moments. I often tell the anecdote of September 11th and when all those schools in Lower Manhattan reopened a couple of weeks after that devastating moment. And those kids, those kids had to make sense of what they had seen that day. And what were they asked to do? They were asked to write their memories. They were asked to draw their memories. They went straight to the humanities, right? The humanities are the thing that save us. I mean, my mother died when I was a child. I watched her die in my father's bedroom. And before she died, she made me keep a journal. The first one I have is when I'm 8 years old. I did a trip to New York by myself. Well, not by my uncle lived there. I wasn't walking the streets as an 8-year-old.
Yeah.
And I realize now that she gave me the greatest gift ever, because she gave me a place to go. She gave me a place to make sense of the world, which is writing.
I had William Brough Adams, the new director at the National Endowment for the Humanities, on this program just the other day, and I think you make the case beautifully for the need for us to continue to understand the importance of the humanities, and Ann Tyler certainly figures into that very well. One thing I do want to get into is how these three siblings relate to each other, what they mean to each other. You have the sister, Jenny, who almost never comes home. You have Cody making every excuse not to come home. And there you have Ezra by his mother's side. Short break here. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rhodes Scholar, with educational travel adventures to 150 countries, including Cuba, at roadscholar.org. From T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at troweprice.com. And from the Joyce Foundation, working to encourage businesses and consumers to save money and electricity through energy efficiency. JoyceFDN.org.
The Kinks' first hit, You Really Got Me, was released in 1964. To celebrate the Kinks' 50th anniversary, there's a new box set collecting their recordings from 1964 to 71. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with the band's lead singer and songwriter, Ray Davies. Join us.
And as we talk about this book, Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant by Ann Tyler, on the day before Thanksgiving, I have a sense that if everyone listening took their own family situation to the Thanksgiving table tomorrow, you'd probably have riots all over the country. I mean, you talked about the fact that you're not at all close to your siblings, Rachel.
No.
I don't think these three people are very close to each
other. These three are much closer than my siblings and I can tell you. I mean, we live in different countries. I haven't spent a holiday with any of my siblings in, oh my gosh, I can't remember when.
Really?
Yeah, or my father.
Your father, is he still living?
He's still living. He lives out west. I see him from time to time because I have a daughter and I want her to have a sense of what it means to have a grandfather, and he's grown softer with age, but you know, I had a very different experience growing up.
Indeed.
I don't think I've spent a Christmas or Thanksgiving with, or, you know, anything with him in probably 15 years.
All right, let's go to Cynthia in Trumansburg, New York. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hi, I enjoyed this book, and my question, I think, is for Kevin Roy. Does he think that the mother, Pearl, suffers from a borderline personality disorder. It's something that I wondered reading it because, you know, she was orphaned so young, so she had the loss young of at a young age of her parents. She was outcast in the family that she stayed with, and all of her extended family of origin. She wasn't able to love. She had so much distrust. She had this pride that was at the other end of her anger, you know, and people couldn't come next to her. And when they were out at Ezra's restaurant and Cody was first getting his job traveling around, and he talks about the Tanner industry where the father had worked, Cody says, oh, that Tanner place, that was a two-bit place, that was nothing. And the mother is insulted. Pearl's like, don't insult me. Why are you saying this? And she walks out angry. And then there's another time on page 70 where Jenny is dreaming that her mother is a witch and would eat her. I mean, this is, you know, I worked in mental health for a little bit, and actually quite a few years, and as a supportive counselor, inpatient, outpatient, did some reading, have some relatives, and I have an interesting family myself. Personally, I believe it's not what happens to you in life, but what you do with it. But does Kevin think that Pearl suffers from a borderline personality disorder? And I could take my answer off the
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for calling.
It's a good question. It is something I thought about. I guess I resist the tendency to kind of assess a lot of mental health issues, particularly in characters. I think they bring up interesting questions. And so it could be that what Anne Tyler's doing is trying to capture the complexity of her emotional experience with her family, and we're kind of getting the jagged edges of it that she's bringing to the table. But I do think what she's struggling with in trying to deal with the deprivation and loss that she's experienced and the relationship with her kids and all the expectations she had about being them, you know, them being a perfect family and working out. Those are important things to pay attention to. They really shape her interactions for decades with her children.
But let's face it, considering the kind of abuse she leveled on those kids, if you saw a neighbor doing that, you'd call the police these days. I mean, she beat them so brutally. It was horrific. Now, either she had a borderline personality or her rage at that stage of her life was so intense she simply could not control herself, Laura.
She couldn't. And then Jenny in The Next Generation. I actually was more upset about the scene in which Jenny's breaking down when she's the mother of a young child, because, I mean, it's so glaring. What does Jenny become? She becomes a pediatrician, someone who takes care of children. And yet, when she is the mother of a small child and she's a single mother, taking your daughter a glass of water in the middle of the night and then slapping her and screaming, take it, take it, that was much more raw to me for some reason. I don't know if it was because I would hope that you hope that people can learn from example, but what we know is they don't necessarily, and that they repeat themselves. Rereading Dinner at a Homesick Restaurant, I was given cause to think a lot about someone, sort of a legendary relative in my in-laws, whom I never knew, but who has been depicted to me as almost kind of a Queen Lear, who would say to her children, who loves me the most, and who changed her favorites on a regular basis.
Whoa.
And this has had consequences for the children and the children beyond and the children beyond. And, you know, I think that is part of the story of Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant. I mean, what is Ezra really trying to create in what I happen to believe is his way ahead of its time restaurant, which if it opened in 2014
absolutely
would be the toast of Baltimore.
Yes. I mean, he's got the whole thing
open plan.
And you can see the people cooking and preparing food. And
barnyard rustic.
Exactly. But, you know, I think it's important for us to point out what a wonderful storyteller Ann Tyler is. We've talked a lot about these characters and their problems, but the story is fabulous.
Her ability to sort of construct the emotional architecture of both the character and the plot and how it moves is just remarkable, really remarkable. I read a review, actually, that said something like, it was a New York Times review when this first came out, and it was something to the effect of, you know, we haven't seen anybody in America who can create this level of complexity and quirkiness with female characters consistently and make them unique from book to book to book. This was like her ninth book or something. And
yeah,
I think that's really right. I think
all
that's
right,
true.
Let's go to Kathleen in Waterford, Michigan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for letting me join this discussion. Ann Tyler is one of my all-time favorite authors.
Oh, good.
And somebody just used the word quirky, and I think that's a perfect description of her wonderful characters. Quirky, interesting, just not your everyday, not your everyday person. I was an English teacher for 38 years, and I used the paragraph, the last paragraph in the first chapter of this book, Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant, it's on page 34. And it is, I think, close to perfection.
Why don't we ask Rachel to read that for us?
It's a beautiful paragraph. Mm. It was such a relief to drift, finally. Why had she spent so long learning how? The traffic sounds, horns and bells and rags of music, flowed around the voices in her room. She kept mislaying her place in time, but it made no difference. All she remembered was equally pleasant. She remembered the feel of wind on summer nights, how it billows through the house and wafts the curtains in smells of tar and roses, how a sleeping baby weighs so heavily on your shoulder, like ripe fruit. What privacy it is to walk in the rain beneath the drip and crackle of your own umbrella. She remembered a country auction she'd attended 40 years ago, where they'd offered up an antique brass bed, complete with all its bedclothes, sheets and blankets, pillow and a linen case embroidered with forget-me-nots. Two men wheeled it onto the platform, and its ruffled coverlets stirred like a young girl's petticoats. Behind her eyelids, Pearl Tall climbed in and laid her head on the pillow and was borne away to the beach, where three small children ran toward her, laughing across the sunlit sand.
Just beautiful. Just absolutely beautiful. Thanks for your call. Let's go to Maggie, who's in Rochester, New York. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Ezra is a sympathetic character.
You bet.
He keeps trying to get the family together at his restaurant. He's so earnest about it. He wants so badly to have them all come together. And I don't think they ever completely finish a meal together there. Pearl gets mad and leaves, or Cody gets mad and leaves. And then at the last scene in the restaurant, when Beck finally returns, he leaves. And they all go off looking for him. So that's all I want.
Well, I think it's an important factor in the book, Laura.
She holds out hope that this might be the dinner that the Tull family finally finishes together. Beck says, Cody urges Beck to, let's go finish our dinner. And Beck says, oh, well, maybe this one last course. But I warn you, I plan to leave before that dessert wine's poured. Yet there is this fragile little hope that maybe this is the dinner where at least Ezra, Jenny, and Cody will stay together. And, you know, Beck doesn't really matter as much. I mean, he's, by his own decision, really not part of the family. But, yeah, this is, you know, it's the dream of family that everyone's going to be chasing tomorrow. You know, why can't we have that perfect dinner? Why can't it look like that Coca-Cola commercial? And everyone chases it, and yet everyone... It was funny, before we started speaking on the air, you referred to the family as dysfunctional, and I feel like the three of us went, well, it just seemed kind of normal to me.
It's normally dysfunctional. It's very Tolstoy. You know, last year on Thanksgiving, I was sick, and I was quarantined. I had the shingles, and I was in bed at my aunt and uncle's house. And I got to tell you, they had to bring a plate up to me. I watched Homeland one episode after another. It was the perfect Thanksgiving. I was completely alone.
There's a front page story in the Washington Post today about Friendsgiving, how a lot of people have decided, no, I think I'll just stay home and hang out with friends. It's much less fraught than being with my family.
Isn't that both interesting and sad?
It is, but it's the reality. It's family is supposed to be this kind of home in a heartless world, right, that we all run to. And Thanksgiving is probably the one time that we all want to go literally in front of the hearth and, you know, gather around it. But that's what makes this book so wonderful, is that there's this continual urge to move it to this perfect place. And that's why I don't see this as dysfunctional. These are folks who are grappling with the realities of family that we usually sweep under the carpet. And that over time, we start to peel back the layers and realize things are a lot more complicated. You know, and the pain and the love we show with each other, and kind of the ebbs and flows of that over time.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show, and to Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Dennis. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thanks, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Two comments. First, to one of your panelists, writers and academicians tend to be black sheep in families, and I am one of those people myself, and I think other family members sometimes just kind of separate out from that family member. And I believe one of your panelists stated she hasn't really spent any time with her family, her father. She has a child. Sometimes this type of family dynamic, I have a cousin who is also an academician, former university president, and he has told me that, you know, within his own family, his brothers, he's had the same kind of experience. My other comment is about the male character in the novel, him leaving his family. There's a British novelist named Hanif Qureshi who wrote a book called Intimacy, and the book caused a lot of outrage in England because it's about a man who leaves his wife and two children. He just gets up one day, leaves the home, leaves them. It actually paralleled what Qureshi himself did to his own family. And it kind of brought home to me the fact that, as in Miss Tyler's book, it's hard to really fathom how people really think and feel. We can project our emotions. I'm the father of two sons. I've been married for 33 years. I would certainly never leave my family, but that doesn't mean I can judge someone else, you know, for what they do, for whatever their particular reasons are. I really don't think we have a real good hold on who people really are and what motivates them to do what they do.
I think you're absolutely right, Kevin. I see you searching for one specific passage.
It's like it made me think of, when I read this book, Beck is of the age, and this is definitely coming out of the 30s and 40s, where rates of desertion were very high. Rates of divorce were not. And so it was very commonplace for men to leave coming out of the Depression.
Interesting.
Very high rates of desertion. And so then you get this odd situation at the end of the book where Beck says, well, I'm still married to your mother. And the kids realize, I guess you're right. You are still married. There was never a divorce.
But Beck, has used that as an excuse.
Absolutely.
Not to marry.
Absolutely.
Again.
And he talks about...
He's a rat. I mean, I think of Beck as a rat. I mean, he leaves this woman totally bereft. He does send her letters occasionally, to let her know where he is, what he's doing. He has affair after affair with various women. He never marries because he doesn't want to be attached.
See, I think of it as his limitations. I think that it's kind of a pathetic existence that he's involved in. Mm-hmm. But he talks about why he left. It was the grayness of things, the half-right, half-wrongness of things. There's a sense that he's not able to engage or attach in the way. And those are the things, all the craziness that involves, that's what really it comes down to in the end. That's what gives everything worth.
Well, what I love about this book, Dinner at the Homesick Restaurant, is that it is all about the yearning for family. In its heart, that's what it's about. Beautiful, beautiful novel. Thank you all so much for joining me. Laura Lippman, her new novel, Hush Hush, comes out in February. Kevin Roy, he's at the University of Maryland. Rachel Louise Snyder, her new novel, What We've Lost is Nothing. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. I'm Diane Rains.